Hello, I'm Sue, and I've been guiding for London Walks for many years now. I'm a City of London guide and a London Blue Badge guide too, also a Freeman of the City of London. I wanted to tell you a little about a walk I do on Sunday afternoons, called Bazaar London. And there are certainly many, many bizarre things to talk about on this walk, as well as a great deal in bad taste. So we'll start, as we mean to go on, with what can only be described as the very worst behaviour. So the first stop is the Tower Hill execution site in the shadow of the Tower of London, which was begun by William the Conqueror, where only a few men and women were beheaded for treason, including three queens. Not something to look forward to exactly, but if you were going to meet that fate, better to have it done privately without a great baying mob in attendance. Not so here, though. Here, 120 men were beheaded, usually the nobility, also for treason. But as in life, due deference was given to their dispatch with an axe as opposed to the hangman's rope, ensuring no unworthy hands touched the exalted personage. And I wanted to mention one victim in particular, the Duke of Monmouth. Now, who was he? Well, he was the eldest son of Charles II, King Charles II, the Merry Monarch, as he was known. Well, it seems he wasn't sufficiently merry with his wife, who remained childless, but made up for it by being extremely merry elsewhere, resulting in 14 illegitimate children. And the Duke of Monmouth was one of them. In fact, he was the eldest one. When Charles died without legitimate heirs, the throne would have passed to his brother, James. The Duke of Monmouth thought otherwise and launched a rebellion, which did him no good whatsoever, and he ended up here. Too late, they remembered they hadn't got a portrait of him. He was whisked off to the Tower of London, head sewn back on. A portrait painter found who was told he had 24 hours to paint a likeness before the face became, quote, less than appealing. It was duly completed. And now, well, there it is. It's in the National Portrait Gallery. A rather fetching, an elaborate white scarf around the neck and a remarkably chirpy expression on the Duke's face, considering the circumstances. As for William the Conqueror, it was also, of course, the Duke of Normandy, and he happened to die out there on his lands in Normandy. And by the time he died, he was not a pretty sight. According to contemporary reports, a terrible stench was arising from his bloated body. You were wanting to bury the body as soon as possible. I don't need to remind you, these are days before refrigeration, morgues and mortuaries. You'd be wanting to get on with it. But there was a long, long delay before they buried William. First of all, they had to prepare the procession to St. Etienne's Abbey in Caen. William was in his coffin. They set off, and then members of the family started squabbling over the spoils in the procession. And everything had to stop while they sorted it all out. A few days go by, they set off again, and then a fire broke out in the procession, and everything had to stop while they repaired the damage. A few more days go, and during this time, the state of William's already bloated body goes from bad to worse, pumping up with poisonous gases. They set off again. And then a man came forward and claimed they were going to bury William partly on land that belonged to his family and claimed compensation. Everything had to stop while they dealt with that as well. But finally, the day comes when they set off up the central aisle of St. Etienne Abbey. Halfway up the aisle, disaster. William's gross and bloated body bursts, splat, all over St. Etienne Abbey. Well, the congregation beetled off, as I think you would, leaving the monks to clear up the mess and scoop as much of William as possible back into his coffin. Well, it seemingly didn't do a very good job, because some centuries later, during the French Revolution, they opened William's coffin and all they found inside it was a bit of mouldy thigh bone, and that is all that got buried of William the Conqueror in the end. Not the sort of behaviour you'd expect from a conqueror. Further on in the walk, we cross a street called St. Mary Axe, A-X-E, named after a little church which was pulled down in the 1500s. Actually, that church was dedicated not just to St. Mary, but also to St. Ursula and the 11,000 virgins. Now, who was she? Well, Ursula came from Brittany in the 5th century, and she gets word that a prince of England wishes to marry her, and she agrees, on condition that he first converts to Christianity, that they then go on their honeymoon on a sort of pilgrimage to Rome. What's more, she wants to take her mates with her, who are the 11,000 virgins. So our princes, I'm all right then, and off they go to Rome. And on the way back, they call in Cologne to convert the heathen. And who are the heathen? Well, this is the 5th century, the Roman Empire being overrun by barbarian hordes. And who are they in that area? Yep, they are the Huns. And their leader is Attila the Hun, faced with 11,000 innocent little faces smiling up at him, come to convert him, thinks all his Christmases have come together in one girl, something like that anyway, and proceeds to behead them three at a time. Now, one of the axes that whacked its way through some 3,000 maidenly necks was brought back here, held in this church, much treasured and presumably much blunted as well, until the church was finally pulled down in the 1500s, hence the name St. Mary Axe. Quite what happened to the Ursula bit of the name, I'm not sure, but if you go to Cologne, you'll find a St. Ursula church there, where many of the bones of the slaughtered remain. They form a sort of rather interesting backdrop to the high altar, an enormous reredos composed entirely of bones. We then come to a church dedicated to St. Helen the Great. Now, she was the mother of Constantine the Great, the Roman emperor who first permitted the practice of Christianity in the Roman Empire back in the 300s. Anyway, she was apparently British. There are many monuments to the great and the good in this church, and indeed a plaque to William Shakespeare, who once lived in a house alongside. But one story I want to tell you about is that of St. Francis Bancroft. He was master of the Draper's Company in the 18th century. Draper's deal is in fine cloth. He was a very wealthy man, and when he died, he was buried inside this church. He left a huge legacy to his company on condition that every year for the next 100 years, on the anniversary of his death, the company should process to the church, solemnly open up his tomb, placing within it a large loaf of bread and a bottle of wine. So a nice ongoing ready meal, ready for the afterlife. Having done so, they would then inquire solicitously after his health, and how are you today, Master Draper? And once satisfied, they might depart. Well, they didn't actually manage 100 years. In fact, they didn't manage for 2 years. Second year, they said, no, we've had enough now. Horrible vision and whatever else assaulted their senses, all became too much. All had to be reburied down in the vaults. Though Sir Francis was a great benefactor, he made sure that no one ever forgot his own family, property, everything concerning himself. All came first before anything was spent on anything else at all. He'd also had some sort of judicial role in the city, something he carried out with such ferocious zeal that he had made many, many enemies over the years. And at his funeral, when he no longer had any power over them, those who had suffered at his hands, with barely concealed rage, exacted their revenge. As he was being laid to rest, they surged into the church and a full-scale riot ensued, thus delaying his burial by several hours. Now, final thing I'll tell you about comes right at the end of the walk, the side of the original Bedlam Lunatic Asylum, where Liverpool Street Station is today. Just beyond St. Botolph's Church was yet another priory. Now, from early days, this priory, like many others, had a small area set aside for hospitality and rudimentary medical help. Not that you were treated very compassionately, you were chained up, and if you misbehaved, you were ducked on the ducking school or whipped at the whipping post. But the hospital grew and grew and grew and became quite substantial. And then Henry VIII came along and closed it down at the Reformation. The patients of these hospitals were chucked out onto the street to fend for themselves, and they were a common sight in the late 16th century, begging for food and shelter. But that didn't happen here. The hospital was so substantial it was given to the city to administer, and it became the first official lunatic asylum. Its name had changed a little bit, though, no longer St. Mary Bethlehem, but St. Mary Bedlam. So this was the site of the first Bedlam Lunatic Asylum. Now, from the early 1600s, it became quite the thing to do, to visit Bedlam, to have a good laugh at the loonies. It was free entertainment. You could walk up and down the corridors, past the cages, in which 9 to 12 of lunatics were chained up. You could prod and poke and laugh and sneer, and everyone had a great time. And this went on until the middle of the 1700s, when doctors decreed it was not good for the tranquillity of the patients, but instead of stopping it altogether, they simply started charging for it so a better class of person could come along. Now, Bedlam as a building moved from this site in the late 1600s, a few hundred yards to the west, to the Moorfields area. And this is when London was being rebuilt after the Great Fire. What they wanted was a veritable Palace of Lunatics, as it was called. A grand building was erected with statues of melancholia and raving lunacy placed outside to forewarn you of what was to come when you entered, and it became a great draw. Along with the Tower of London and Westminster Abbey, this was a must-see attraction for the visitor to London. Those you would see being treated were deemed those who could take it. The more meek, as it was said, were liable to be chucked out early, which was possibly a blessing in disguise. The idea was to demonstrate treatments aimed at removing the madness from the patient. So a favourable sight was to see a patient placed on a chair, suspended from the ceiling by a chain. This was then spun round 100 times a minute. The witnesses were duly impressed by the madness in the form of vomit, departing the body at a speed of knots. That is, I suppose, unless you were seated a little too close. So Bedlam as a building has gone. Bedlam as a word certainly has not. It has come down to us today to mean noise, confusion and chaos, and above all else, chaos. If I remind you, what's been built above on the site, really the original Bedlam Lunatic Asylum, is Liverpool Street Station. If you were to visit the station any day of the week in the rush hour, you might very well feel that Bedlam has never actually gone away from this site. And just as a final thought, you could say that the patients of Bedlam still make their presence felt, their skeletons having resurfaced by the dozen during the excavations for the new underground line under Liverpool Street Station. So that's just a few of the stories in this walk. It's great fun, extremely tasteless. It's a lovely way to spend a Sunday afternoon. So I do hope we're up and running again and lockdown's over. I do hope to see some of you come on this walk. Thanks.